Bound Fiction. This is episode 25.
I like how you say you're like really excited about 25 when nobody probably knows your theory.
Yeah, so that's not even my theory. Like, that's like been studied or proven or something. Is that
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Sort of like the people don't watch after 30 seconds of like a YouTube video or whatever.
Or like a percentage of restaurants go out of business in their first year. But
yeah,
episode 25 episodes for a podcast is supposedly the number of podcasts that have to happen before like a podcast sort of colloquially sticks around. And we made it. We made it. Yeah. So we're going to definitely stick around.
This is our last episode. We had a good run.
You keep threatening with that. we are Make It Sound Fiction. We are the pop culture and media podcast that I'm assuming you usually regularly listen to. And I am your host, Nico, and I'm here with my co-host,
Tyler.
Yeah, and we're back this week. And for every other week in the foreseeable future, forever and ever, ad infinitum, because we're here to stay. So hopefully, I mean, you know.
That means we have to do GODY Awards.
No!
Our GODY Awards would be really bad. We don't play anything.
That's the problem is that, like, we specifically made this podcast not just about video games, so we don't technically have to do GODY anything. At all.
Well, I'm just going to say Red Dead Redemption 2's Game of the Year because it got stolen at the Game Awards. My favorite game.
Some people are going to not realize that you're being sarcastic.
Best narrative? What are you talking about?
Most horses.
Yeah.
So we're actually today, I'm excited because it's very rare that we actually read or listen or watch the same thing at the same time. However, the stars aligned this week and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse came out this week and both of us saw it in a movie theater. Not together, yeah. But like two separate movie theaters to see the movie.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of people, but I also went at like noon on a Saturday, so.
Yeah, same. I went at 10 a.m. because that is my preferred.
I don't know. I don't honestly go to the theaters that often, so I guess I didn't even know what to expect, really. I didn't expect that many people, but I didn't know because, I don't know, this movie, that was one of the things that I was seeing is this movie didn't really get a lot. It got buzz, but it just wasn't the same as like a Marvel cinematic like universe movie kind of thing. Like, yeah. It just seemed like they didn't give it as much. It seemed like the hype was more like from people, like not
from Twitter and social media.
Yeah, like Twitter and stuff, just because of the way it looked. It seemed like less of it was like trying to like force you to be excited about it, which is, I mean, that, maybe that's good, but it's just interesting, I guess.
Well, that's the problem is that like when so much of a success of a movie is based on box office sales, that first week is a big deal, and not getting promoted is not great. Which is weird. I mean, like, here's the thing. Is both of us know enough about the movie industry where under-promoting a movie that centrally features a black character in a comic book universe that is, you know, pretty... low.
A character that's like teased in like the regular Spider-Man, like,
but never
Marvel
gets
cinematic.
To be in the regular Marvel universe. Like, it's a big deal, and they should have done more to promote it. Also, because like, I mean, if we're just cynically talking about money numbers, Black Panther did unbelievable box office numbers because it was heavily promoted. Word of mouth was huge. I just feel like there wasn't as much marketing for this as
there really wasn't. And it's weird because I was reading a review on The Root. Is that what that site's called?
Yeah, The Root. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he was talking about how like he was worried that this film was going to be underpromoted and then also like just turn out to be like an ensemble cast and like Miles Morales wouldn't be
a central
really
figure.
The main character at all. It wouldn't really be about him. It would be about all the different characters. So, and it didn't, which is good, but it's easy to think that because that's just how these things usually go.
Yeah. I mean, Yeah, black characters don't get to carry a movie all the time, which is interesting because we've clearly seen in the last 2 years with like Black Panther and Get Out and Sorry to Bother You, and that there are so many black filmmakers and black artists and black characters that can carry a movie, that can be on movie posters and really, you know, do big numbers, but also be part of quality artistic filmmaking. And like Into the Spider-Verse is one of the best looking animated features I have ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah, it's the most unique, especially because they definitely, I mean, that was apparently a goal, is like they just wanted this to be different, like differently animated than everything you've seen.
Yeah.
And it really nails it. And it nails it in a way that isn't like, oh, that's sort of novel. Like, because I think that's easy to get that from the, because honestly, that's kind of what I thought maybe it would be when I watched the trailers. It was like, oh, it's kind of neat that they're doing like the, I figured out the name of this, the Ben Day dots. Like from, I guess those are from like comics, like the little dots.
Yes.
Like in the, yeah. Like doing that and then doing like the, not thought bubbles, but like the little like the text on the screen, whatever you call those. They're not thought bubbles. They're like the ones that are like him thinking.
Yeah, like, but like there's like dialogue and speech captions.
Yeah, stuff like that. And then the way that like the, just like the colors would shift and stuff like that. Like I thought it would be like really novel and like cool looking, but like, eh, like it was okay movie, but not, you know, it clearly was like about the technical part of it, but it wasn't. It was definitely excelling on both fronts, I guess. Cause like it just, I don't know. I think they work so, the animation and the narrative work so well together, and they just like hold, like, I don't know, I feel like they're holding hands and just like bring you through this movie. Because so much of the animation just supports the narrative and the other way around too, and it just feels like, it just feels really thorough. Like it really feels like they really, like, it wasn't just about one of those things. They definitely wanted to make a film still. Or sometimes, I don't know, I feel like, at least in games, this happens a lot where it's like, oh, you wanted to make this cool tech thing, but you forgot you wanted to make a game, and so you just make this really like weird tech demo-y thing that is neat, but maybe not actually lasting or anything or meaningful. And that is just the opposite of what Spider-Verse is. And I was kind of surprised, even though I was really excited about the film, I was surprised still.
Yeah. It has visuals that really keep up with the narrative, and the narrative that keeps up with the visuals. And I feel like so many animated films, especially now in the heyday of 3D, you know, DreamWorks, Pixar, things that revel in the fact that we can do 3D animation and
look at this snow style that's like packing, like getting packed and like and falling over itself and stuff like that. Like, look how detailed it is.
Like all of these, and it's interesting because I don't think it's quite gotten to the level that like games likes to do with hyper realistic stuff. Like Pixar has a house look to it.
Yeah,
it you know always still looks like a animated film, but it I don't know, 3D animation is never going to make me feel the same way as 2D animation. It's just not. It never is. And
it's probably because, is it because 3D is always, I don't know, there's more abstraction in 2D.
There's more.
Obviously because it's not as realistic, but
with 3D, they still try to, I mean, 3D animation lets you do the same, you know, squash and stretch and principles of animation and what looks good, smear frames, you know, any tweening, all that stuff that makes the animation go. You're always going to get that with 3D animation, but I feel like 2D animation just has an elasticity and a novelness to it in some capacity that 3D animation is still so concerned with just, you know, things that are more apparent with 3D, which is like hair, the way hair moves. Like, think of like Tangled or Brave with like all the hair and how the hair looks and how people move and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And
I haven't actually seen either of those.
Oh,
movies,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, okay, yeah. Fine. I've seen a lot.
I mean, I can imagine the trailers for them, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like just the hair and how things move, and there's a novelness to that, but it's like 2D yeah. animation has that kind of like it can just kind of do things with physicality that are just like you said, more abstracted from reality, I think.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see that in Spider-Verse, because this is the first movie I think I've ever actually seen that has managed to bridge the gap between comic books and film, which is something yeah. I thought was impossible. Because
they always try it in like the regular live action films. They try to do scenes that just very that, like in a way the silhouettes just look like a, you know, a comic book cover.
Yeah.
But they never really like they look good, but they don't. Some of that stuff just doesn't really work in live action, and it probably doesn't really work in 3D.
Yeah.
As much.
Well, it's we've been doing. Here's the thing: is that there's comic books have a long history. Animation has a decently long history, and we have been doing comic book animated series for yeah. years, TV shows. Like, you know, like I have seen so many animated shows that are based on comic books. The ones that I would say stand out the most to me are things like Batman the Animated Series, in terms of having like an aesthetic that they stick to and cut, but you know, that's bringing the character designs to life one-to-one. Okay, that's awesome. It's cool to see comic book characters come to life and move. That's cool. But the thing that Spider-Verse managed to do was take the things about sequential art, which is funny, because as we know, animation is just sequential art sped up to
yeah.
you know, 24 frames per second or whatever. Or, you know, 29 or whatever. It takes the peculiarities of sequential art and makes them a part of the cinematic experience, which is a tall order, and manages to just straddle the line between the two of them, because there's absolutely frames... The movie is so visually dense because it's doing so many things of like animating, but also framing things in a way that would look like it was on a page for like half a second. Like,
yeah,
like a fit,
they
like
do
a
lot
of
things
a
where it's like he's running and we're going to cut to show like his legs running and hitting the ground, but then cut again to uh-huh. like him sprinting in a wider view kind of thing. Like
it looks like somebody yeah. brought a storyboard to life, because if yeah. you don't know, storyboarding is pretty essential for any animated feature and films in general. It's a way to set up like what shots are going to look like, and it's usually people very roughly thumbnailing the kind of the key frames of
yeah.
each scene beat by beat. And it looks like somebody basically took their storyboarding and then managed to bring that into the 3D element. Whereas like most 3D films, they move the camera in kind of a predictable way, because you can move the camera around in 3D animation that you can't really do necessarily with like traditional filmmaking. So that's, you know, one reason that 3D animation is so elaborate, is you can move the camera literally anywhere. The camera exists in the same place as the models and stuff, so you can, you know, fly it through however, but it always feels like sometimes it kind of takes the same it does, you know, some 3D films really don't have that kind of inspired cinematography, whereas
yeah.
this feels like it absolutely took all of the cues for like shots and framing and action in particular, all of the camera cues from comic books. So and that's really where that jump happens. That's really where you kind
yeah.
of get that
well,
visual
part
direction.
Part of the tech that they did for this was that it, whatever it was, it allowed for a lot more hand-drawn stuff to just be implemented immediately.
Yeah.
Apparently, yeah. Like, just on the screen, that is what you drew, kind of, and then you can play with it. So that makes sense. When you say that it's like they added storyboarding to it directly, so I think that's kind of essentially what it actually is.
They literally had people, like, doing drawn elements over that's the 3D rendered. Yeah,
it's a little complex, but it sounds like it allowed for more drawn stuff to just be in it. Just, like, kind of, there was a game that had that tech too, where it was just like a lot of it was hand drawn. Was it Cuphead, or was it the Yarny game?
No.
It might have been Cuphead. There was some that was like they talked about the tech of like we could just sort of draw this stuff and we could just have it be manipulatable, like we can manipulate it like in a 3D world. Mm-hmm. And apparently that's essentially what Spider-Verse has, where a lot of the 2D stuff, it's 2D, but they can move it around like a 3D object.
Yeah.
So they can like stretch it and stuff like that. So that's apparently, but so you're right. Like whatever you like, the feeling of it just being a storyboard sounds like they were able to just draw scenes and that was just what's there.
I mean,
which is really interesting. Yeah.
It still looks like a 3D movie. Well, you know, yeah. In certain places.
A lot of the backgrounds and stuff are very kind of traditional looking, but that's fine.
But they're, it's like, totally fine.
3D, yeah.
But they definitely do a lot of rendering to it to make it look like stuff breaks into screen tones.
Yeah.
Or has the like slight like channel, which is funny because breaking apart color channels is a digital effect. And then they also do things like they're breaking into screen tones, which is the analog version of the digital effect of breaking apart channels, because breaking things into screen tones is from when they used to print this stuff.
Yeah.
But then also, like, we were talking about this, you know, off mic. You were talking about how, like, a lot of the action sequences is where a lot more of the comic book feel kind of comes into it. Like all of the like movement and the action and stuff, like it's just
got that kind of like snap to it.
Yeah.
It's got that like, it's like movement, then a hard stop, movement, then a hard stop, which is something that you just don't see in other things because it's like you're seeing a panel in a comic and then looking at the next one, but that's a scene.
Yeah.
Which is so, yeah.
It kind of mimics. I've mentioned Scott McCloud on here before. Scott McCloud is a comic book illustrator, but also has written several books on how comics function. And one of the ways that comics draws you through action sequences in particular is how things are laid out on the page, how big panels are, how thick the borders are, how it's broken up. Is it... And because what it's doing is it's carrying your eye through the panels much in the same way that animation just did that by speeding up the drawings. So animation took kind of what comics were doing with your eye and just made it seamless, you know, so you watch the action instead of having to, like, you know, do kind of the heavy lifting yourself. And this film, we've seen a couple of tweets about this. Like you said, it holds for a beat or it holds for a couple of frames.
Yeah.
So you get that effect of your eye racing through a page of panels in a comic book, or like flipping the pages really quickly to kind of see what happens next.
Yeah. So, and it's like a
moment. You get to take a moment.
Which is, it's really interesting when you compare that to the action scenes that are heavily criticized in, like, the MCU movies, because they're just hard to follow, because it's like, wait, who punched who? And wait, did they fall? Or, like, where are we even at? And I think this movie is just like, well, we don't need to have a really elaborate fighting stuff, I mean, even though it does. But it just shows it in a way that is, it's already got an impact that it doesn't have to be elaborate, because it's... like, it's like filmically, like, it's just like impactful to watch, so you don't need it to be just really long and elaborate to make it feel like it has a point. And it's like kind of like it's I guess a little bit elegant in that way for a fighting scene, because it's just like they don't have to be long and they don't have to like convince you that it's that the fighting is real, you know what I mean? Or the fighting is like consequential because it already has a feel to it.
They can also just like they can abstract some of the visuals, they can abstract some of the fighting. Like, you don't need to have every punch land because it's physical, real actors or stunt people doing this. And that's why a lot of fight scenes in action movies are very much like jiggly camera, hard cuts, quick cuts, because they need to hide that these people are not good at fighting. Whereas in animation, and this is why I wish we would, as a culture, let ourselves make more animated features, is because, you can do the fantasy of a fight. You can do things that human actors can never do, like stop a fight halfway through for 3 frames so that you can see where that punch from one character is going to land, but also that punch can be from like miles away, and you can do very cartoony things like stretch a person's leg out or hyper focus on the like details in a hand or a foot or in the case of Spider-Man, do the ridiculous like sound effect words in the background,
like wham, pow,
bam, flap, whip, you know, like. And I felt that was, they really had very good judicious use of bringing in those static visual elements from the comics into the non-static movement of the film to just give it that flavor. But it's like, man, I watched this film and I'm gonna go see it again because I know there was so much stuff that I missed because every frame is jam-packed with like visual information, like just intense.
And it's like, it's framed really well, it's like blocked out really well too, because like it just, a lot of the, I don't know, because they just had control over everything, and it just looks really good. I watched it in 3D and you didn't. The 3D, I don't know, it's weird because I didn't see the regular one, but the 3D added obviously depth, which, you know, might be a lot for this film. I don't know, but there were definitely some scenes where it's just there was one where he climbs to the top of like a building. And he's going to do the like Spider-Man, I don't know my powers yet, but I'm going to jump off of this building and see what happens and try to like web sling my way or maybe super jump kind of thing. And then, he has him up there and he's like, you know, heavily, like he's like, you know, nervous. And then it cuts to like a wider view of him, like in the middle of the screen. And it's like this, you know, you see the city behind him and this like big building below him. And there's like snow. And that looked really good 3D because the snow just sort of surrounded. It was like behind him, but in front of you. And it just felt like kind of that cold, like winter day that doesn't really have much, like it's sort of silent, but you can sort of feel the snow. It feels cold. And that stuff, there's a lot of moments like that in the film that because the film stops a lot, I think that those have more of an impact than maybe another 3D movie, because like they sit there for a second and you can really kind of be in the moment for a second, like for a little bit more than maybe you would be otherwise. So the 3D is neat. I don't know. Like it definitely didn't have a lot of the like gag stuff of like stuff flying out at you, the sort of not gag, but like, kind of like,
we don't know what to do with 3D. So we're going to have things pop out of the artificial screen,
just like stuff flying out of you. Yeah. I mean, there is stuff that it like comes out a little bit, but it's not like, it's not anybody like reaching into something and it's like at your face. It's nothing too obvious. It's not gimmicky. That was the word I was looking for. But I did like, I don't know. This is hard because my favorite thing about the film is like, it's not a spoiler, but it's the thing I keep saying, but I still think it's amazing that this movie got there. I don't know if I could say it. I'm asking you for permission.
What do you mean?
For permission to talk about the stuff I keep talking about, the fighting scenes.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Okay, well, I just think that, like, I think it's really amazing that this film cares. Well, first of all, I think it's really big that it cares about its characters so much, because I think one of the things I was thinking about a little bit ago, actually, was one thing I always have an issue with the MCU movies a lot is that sometimes it feels like they're still kind of self-conscious or like a weird, like they feel weird about the fact that they're comic book movies sometimes, even though they're way bigger than that now. Sometimes it feels like the stakes are so high and all the shots are so like cataclysmic or whatever, right? Like explosions and everything, or everything has to have huge stakes because then it's okay to have a movie about a guy who, like, you know, wall climbs and like shoots web, right?
They have to try, like, to make it more serious than it needs to be.
Yeah, because they have to, like, because I mean probably because of the live action too, because it's people, but I just feel like this movie was like, well, you bought the tickets to watch a Spider-Man movie, so we don't really have to convince you that the guy has powers and that's kind of weird in your life, but it's like, it just, like, the suspension of disbelief is just assumed.
Well,
so
it's
hard.
Animated. It's yeah. not real. See, and you don't have to make yeah. it real, and it doesn't have to look real or
so
feel
just,
real.
Yeah, so I guess that goes to your point about like being more like being more open to just having animated films, because I just liked how, I think that helps this movie a lot, because it doesn't have to spend time with like the origin stories. It doesn't have to spend time with like making you feel okay with a guy like wall climbing, right?
Yeah.
But I think that because it cares so much about its characters, and because it convinces you that they're all interesting, it doesn't, and like I was saying this yesterday to you too, that like they don't even have to do the thing where a lot of Spider-Man media often tries to be like, it tries to adhere to like, oh, let's have Peter Parker in it, and Peter Parker is going to be like a wisecracking Spider-Man. He's going to be actually funny in this one, because everyone always complains about Spider-Man always being like too dour in the Raimi films or whatever, like in some of the games too, he's like not really funny. And so that was the big thing about the recent game this year, was like, oh, he's actually kind of funny, and like even the Homecoming movie, he's funny. But yeah, like this movie was just like, no, we're just like, yes, Peter Parker's in here and it is funny, but like we just have different characters. They're Spider-Men and Spider-Women, but like we're not going to try to like make the Peter Parker that you like grew up with necessarily. These are just characters, like, because the comics have been playing around with different Spider-Men like people for a while, right? So like they don't need to just keep remaking that same character.
Excuse me, Spider, it's not just Ham, spider
also.
People, it's yeah. spider pinks too.
Yeah. So I think that they just convince you so much. They do so much. I think, I don't know, one of the things I think about with movies and stories a lot, just stories honestly, is that like you have to sell me on the characters, because I won't care about anything if I don't care about the characters. I mean, that's obvious, but like sometimes it seems like a lot of fiction forgets that, and it's annoying.
Especially fiction that has to adapt something, it feels like it loses something yeah. in translation of like,
it's always like just like a big reference or like winking at you sometimes too.
Versus like,
where, yeah,
you know, like I don't read superhero comics. I never
have. I don't
either. And yeah. I predominantly get Marvel and DC stuff through animated features, TV shows,
Netflix shows.
Like, so you gotta tell me why I yeah. need to care about Jessica Jones or Spider-Man or Daredevil.
Yeah. And you
or
just
anything
make
that.
Them characters. You'll care because you like, everybody likes stories. Like,
everybody
you don't have
loves
to,
stories.
You don't have to convince Nico that like the DC comic run here was really amazing. You just make a good character.
Yeah, or this well-known loved character becomes a stand-in for some other story. Like, that's
yeah.
one of the things that comics really excels at, is like, sure, you could do an original comic about some topic and maybe you'll get a couple of people to read it, but why not explore a theme or a
right.
narrative?
That's what the Black Panther
yeah, like,
comics have been doing, right? Is
yeah.
like they're
yeah.
just exploring bigger things, but they're still Black Panther.
Yes, but using yeah. a referential character that people know and people kind of know the lay of the land with.
Yeah, so it's sort of like palettes. Like, you're just using a different sort of medium/palette kind of to
yeah,
tell something
so it's,
else.
It's
yeah.
kind of like fan fiction. It's almost yeah. like comic books are just canonized official fan fiction. You know, it's like
yeah.
the Spider-Man movie did a really good job of saying, well, we have this multi-universe concept that's a big part of this story. It's going to be the vehicle for us being able to play around with so many different versions of
yeah.
Spider-Man. But that's just a veneer for, well, what does Spider-Man, the idea, actually mean?
yeah.
And I think that it did a really good job of sort of you know, and they even say it in the movie at one point, you know, Spider-Man can be anyone. It can be anyone, you know?
Yeah, that it was actually a really good Stan Lee cameo in this, like even though I won't spoil it, but it's a really good one, I think, just especially
in light of the fact that he's no longer with us.
I think that they work so hard to make these characters compelling, and it works so well that, like, you can get to the point where the end, like near the end of the film, when there's a lot of fighting and stuff, like, they're not like another comparison to the MCU movies that bugs me is, like, a lot of those, like, finals fight scenes and stuff are so focused on either the fighting, like, abstracted as just like, here's a good action scene because you've been waiting for it, or like, here's a bunch of buildings exploding or whatever, or like whatever the big MacGuffin thing that is happening, or aliens ships or whatever. It's usually the view of, like, the camera just, like, sits on that stuff, and it's just like, look at the destruction, like, look at how, like, look how big the stakes are again. And this movie, even when it gets there, you care so much about the characters that by the end they're just fighting on, like, abstract art. Like, they're not even like, there is an explosion, I won't spoil that, but, like, it doesn't even care about that. It just uses that as a background to just have these characters do the things you've been waiting for them to do, which involves fighting, but, like, it just doesn't even, I don't know, there was a moment in the theater where I was just, like, sitting there, and I was just like, I cannot believe that I'm just watching characters, like, fight on, like, weird, like, background art that doesn't have anything, no basis in reality.
Yeah.
And I'm totally convinced, like, I don't care that there's weird, like, purple and pink bubbles floating up that don't really make any sense, but it just looks so amazing, and I'm so tied to the characters and what they're doing that I just don't care, like, because it doesn't matter. I mean, I love it, but I also don't care about the realism of it, which, I mean, obviously it's animated, but, like, I think more, like, fiction and more stories should be more, like, I don't know, like, more courageous to know where the audience is at, and to be able to convince them that, like, I don't know, you can have, like, a crescendo to a moment that is, like, absurd otherwise, but you've built somebody there, you've built them to that point with the storytelling and the visuals and stuff, that it doesn't matter, kind of thing. Whatever, I'm doing it. So Dark Souls 3 also does this, where it basically, I mean, I'm spoiling it. It basically ends with, like, this, you're in this world where I don't know how to explain it, but it's just, like, a bunch of buildings and a bunch of stuff you've seen throughout the game. It's just, like, collapsing in on itself. And that's just been, like, the story to that point, is, like, stuff is shifting in and out, and, like, you're seeing old places that you recognize from before, but they're slightly off, and they're also, like, under places that they weren't before, like, they weren't under before, and it just always seems weird. So by the end, when everything is just, like, twisting in on itself, it seems like, okay, this is where we are. Like, this isn't weird. If you saw that at the beginning of the game, you would be like, this is really wild. Like, what the heck is happening? But it feels normal. Like, they normalized it through just telling the story. And that's what Spider-Verse does. And I thought that was just, like, I don't know, I thought it was just an amazing moment that you could just have just tons of, like, it's just so art forward. Like, it's just, like, because so much of the movie is about animation and art that by the end, that's all it is, I don't know. I just think that's really, like, tremendous. And I was just really impressed.
The, like, whole, like, layering or sort of things intersecting on itself or things like that, like, there's been CGI effects in several movies that have done stuff like that. Like, I'm thinking, like, Inception. I'm thinking...
Yeah, Inception does that too.
Inception does it, but also one of the other Marvel movies for Doctor Strange does a lot of stuff like that.
Oh, and I've always wanted... I know people don't love that movie, but I do want to watch that at some point.
It's so bad. It's so bad, but that stuff looked cool. This movie was a way better version of that stuff. Like, because it sets it up way better, it can pull it off visually because it doesn't have to be realistic. Mm-hmm. And that's why I found so compelling, is it just did a lot of, like, it just did a lot of things in a really neat sort of elegant way.
Like it knew that I was on the same track. Like, it just never doubted that it was gonna lose me. It just didn't feel like it was worried that I would forget, or, like, worried that I would not understand what is happening. And it, like, it just felt like a, I don't know, I feel like the best media that, or the stuff that I love the most is the stuff that just feels like it's there with me. Like, there's a bond there with, like, the storytelling, and you just, like, you're just there on every level. And that's what this film felt like. It just seemed to understand how to get me to where it wanted me to go. And then, I don't know, it just felt like it was just told so well and shown so well that I don't know, it just didn't like, I don't know, never doubted me, which I think is like a big thing, because that's a thing that often bugs me in a lot of like stories. It's just stuff that like it feels like it treats me like either I'm stupid or it is so worried about over explaining something when it doesn't need to. Like I've talked about on the podcast about like shorthanding things when we don't need to see stuff. And that's a lot of this film is a lot of shorthand, because it you've seen it all. You've seen the origin story.
They did really good. They did really good, yeah. Like, origin story lead ups. They compressed everybody's origin story into like maybe 30 seconds, which was, and they did it sort of, that's where it condensed itself very much into like a comic book format of just like shot, 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 like really.
And it would do things too, which it would do musical cues for different characters, including like the, I don't know the name of the enemy character that is like chasing him at one point, with the claw. Is it like the claw or something? I don't know
he has a name and it's mentioned in the movie. The Prowler.
Oh, is it?
It's the Prowler. It's the Prowler.
The Prowler. Yeah. Like the Prowler's musical cues are just like terrifying and like they're startling, and but they work really well because it'll do things. And this is like an example of what we've been talking about, was like he's chasing you or he's chasing Spider-Man, and like it does the like kind of like how would you describe that, like the musical cue for him? It's just like kind of like, it's just like loud and blaring, but also like kind of crunchy, and like, I don't know, something about it just like really menacing, but not like over the top menacing. It's very like rushed. I don't know, the sound is really good. But it does things where it's like he'll take his claw out or whatever, and it like zooms in and does like art around like his claw, like green, like kind of like outlining, which is like, you know, very comic book, but also just in the middle of a scene where he's chasing him. And that's kind of what we were talking about with like it'll just do comic book like static stuff just to like emphasize. But it does that so much that I think it I don't know, it feels so normal by the end that like, yeah, when they just, I don't know, it's just it's really good. I really like it. I don't know, it's so hard to, there's so much I like that, because they're like, you said, seeing it a second time through, you're probably going to notice a lot more of stuff like that, because there is just a lot happening, but it's not overwhelming, I don't think. Or like when it is overwhelming, it's supposed to be, I feel like. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
I always have trouble watching stuff in theaters because
yeah, stuff. I miss his name. I guess I just completely missed the Prowler, but
I really the story was a little bit lighter than I was expecting, but it did so in such an expedient way that I didn't care, and they did a really good job of balancing Miles's story with everybody else's as an ensemble cast, and you kind of understand what they're for, and that's to sort of propel Miles, and that this is still really his story, but it's interesting that his story doesn't really become a spider person story until his life kind of comes to the point that all of the other spider people's lives comes to, which is kind of tragic on some level. If it's defined by loss and alienation.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, yeah.
And then you're sad because he realizes he had to have that moment too to really kind of come into that reality. And that's where you kind of get the idea that there, even though being a spider person is cool, there's a price for that.
Yeah,
there's always a price, and it does it in such
it
a simple way
to. Yeah, it does, because they each have their, so their backstories, which includes loss. I wish it did a little bit more with Kingpin with that, in that respect, because
yes.
I think they were trying to say something about like, here's Kingpin trying to do something about like the grief he's experiencing, but it doesn't quite tie up neatly, I guess, with the spider people and Pig, because it just, I don't know, something about, I liked that. I like that they tried to do that, but it does, not it doesn't enough really time. Work.
There was not enough time to really flesh out.
I also
out
feel like the stuff with the uncle also wasn't completely, it was interesting, but it didn't really go anywhere either. Like, it didn't feel like a complete
thing. Yeah, to me. I feel like sometimes some things could really work as like a 4-part mini series versus a 10-episode Netflix show, because this also could have worked as a Netflix show.
Yeah.
Versus like the limits of like an animated film, because we didn't really get any reason to sympathize that much with Kingpin, because he's just sort of dropped into the story as the antagonist and not much else. Same with Olivia.
And he's really visually imposing too.
But we never like, and it's interesting because we get so much catharsis with Kingpin in, if you watch the Daredevil show on Netflix, you get so much more about Kingpin in that version.
That's a good point. That's who I was really thinking of. I'm like, they kind of try to do that Kingpin.
They kind of
try to be like, he's vulnerable though, and he gets really mad because of a reason, but they
don't have any time.
Nail it. Yeah, they don't have time. Well, they don't really make themselves a lot of time, because he kind of only shows up when there's when it's a kind of a culmination of something, right? Like, he is really just a villain.
Oh yeah, he's a villain that's sort of in the background of like the rest of the stuff. Yeah. Obviously, because
I was gonna say, like, Daredevil like had a story. His story was like the other, like it was like a story alongside Daredevil.
Yeah, because he was actively partaking in sort of the destruction of Daredevil's like stomping grounds, you know, basically. Whereas Kingpin in this, his villainy is related to something that really isn't related to Spider-Man, but Spider-Man obviously has to show up and like stop him, you know, because he's destroying things for the purposes of his plan, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the only part about this movie and the story that I actually found the least interesting, was like, I never got why we're supposed to understand or care what Kingpin is doing. It's just kind of there to provide, you know, something.
I tried to get there, but yeah.
It's too simple, and you find out way too late what the reason is.
You find out way too late, I think, honestly.
Yeah,
you know, like, I think if you found out earlier, you could, and then if they did a little bit more and tied it in with the stuff with the other characters, I think maybe they could get somewhere with, because in a way, this movie is about loss, but it just doesn't really. Yeah, I guess there's just nothing getting you to feel any empathy towards Kingpin, really, because they just don't give him a lot of time, and they only show him when he's like very, very villainous. Like, they don't really show any vulnerability to him other than like as a an explanation.
there was also some other things, like how Gwen decided to like disguise herself as like a school kid for some reason instead of just finding Miles.
Because of like fate kind of thing.
All of them showing up at like Aunt May's ahead of everybody else, I guess. And you know, there's
I think that wasn't that explained, because like everybody would obviously go to her because that's
they were just magically all waiting there. Like, there are definitely a little bit of moments of like, oh, this is still a kids movie, because kids are gonna fucking care. Kids don't care about picking apart the like nuances of the story or whatever. Like,
the other thing I actually thought that was a little bit manipulative, I guess, to me, was the like, I mean, I can't spoil it, but there's a thing that is sad that happens at the end that is in between like fighting.
Oh my god! I thought that was so silly.
Like, I was like, wait, hold on! Like, this is horrible, but we're just gonna. I mean, I know that it's not as bad as it might seem,
but
it's
we're just gonna breeze right by it.
Yeah, I was kind of like, okay,
cool. I guess, like, the story is not 100% perfect, but. Because I had a feeling they had to cram so much stuff into it. But everything with Miles, I wish that they had actually cut some of the scenes a little bit shorter if it meant that we got to spend more time with, like, Miles and his parents, basically, because they were, like, the best part of that movie. Like, I just...
Yeah, his dad, like, his relationship with his dad was a lot. Good. And there wasn't a lot of it, but it was a lot.
It did a lot for what it was, I think. And
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. This is a really good movie. I hope it wins awards because I like to see genre film win.
It's won one already, I think.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's also nominated for a couple. So
I hope it is because it's beautiful. It does a lot of very novel, innovative things in a way that I've never seen, and it kind of understands the purpose and the meaningfulness of comic books and brings it to the cinema. It brings Miles Morales and his sensibility. Like, that's the thing is, like, obviously I'm speaking as a white person here, so take this with a grain of salt. But I just like the fact that you really sort of, like, why I like Spider-Man Homecoming is you really got a sense of Miles and his personality, and, you know, it has a lot of, like, contemporary music. It has him running around in, like, a hoodie and shorts with, like, the spider gear underneath
his it. His suit has, like, sneakers. It's not...
His suit has sneakers, and he spray-painted the logo on it. Like, you really get a sense of who Miles is as a character from these little, like, visual details, things in the background, music he listens to, the
but
way
also
he
just
carries
the way he
himself.
Acts, I feel like.
The way he what?
I just think, like, the way he acts, like, the way he won't just be, like, he's not, like, the good, like, Peter Parker character that is just, like, going to school and he's a nerd. He's like, no, I'm going to do graffiti because it's kind of fun and, like, feels adventurous because that's what I do. Because, you know, the whole no expectations thing, like,
well, that's
that is just him.
That's one of the reasons I find that is why Miles Morales is such a really better version of Spider-Man for the how the comics are, because when Peter Parker was created, he was of the era he was created
in. He was written for the readers
of that time, where it was just like Queens had a lot of white people.
Yeah.
And Queens does not have all white people now. Queens is an extremely diverse neighborhood, or, you know, a borough. It's like, you know, the crossroads of the world. And Miles Morales is a face you would see walking down the street in Queens, and he listens to, you know, rap music and hip hop, and he, you know, tags stuff, and that's, like, so much more contemporary and updated than, you know, every other vision of Peter Parker. And it sells the idea more that Spider-Man could be anybody, you know. Which is also kind of fans out a little bit amongst the other spider people too, because you have, you know, Gwen and Peter B. Parker, and you sort of see these, like, shattering, like, sort of facets of what Spider-Man could be. But I feel that Miles just brings a heart to it and brings a realism and brings, like, you know, like, I'm too busy drawing and listening to music to be able to get back to school and stuff like this.
Yeah. You know? I think it also just really demonstrates, just like Black Panther, that characters can be anyone. Like, your main character can just be actually anyone, as long as you're, you know.
And people, like, will go and see it, and people will find it relatable regardless, and that you need
your hero can be anyone, because it's the same normal hero story. Like, it is the same hero's journey in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But
you also need to, like, every time we've spoken about representation, the thing is that it's not just important, I think, for, like, you know, Black Latinx kids to see a character like them, like, to see, like, a mixed Black kid speaking Spanish. Like, that's a big deal. But also, the earlier you start seeing different people from you in your media, the more, and this is definitely true for white people, is, like, the more you see them as human too, like yourself. Yeah. And, you know, I was in a theater with, like, I would say 50-50 Black and white audience sort of thing. And it was, like, a lot of, like, young white boy, like, you know, kids.
Yeah, that was what my theater was.
Yeah, and they were like still whooping and wall hollering and laughing and having a really good time. And it's like, if you just treat it as normal, if you just treat it as like just as important.
Yeah, just as important, I think, is the difference.
Yeah, that's what happens, you know. So it's, it's doing a lot of things, and I found it very fun and a really good time. And so, yeah, I think everybody should see it. Hopefully everybody sees it. So,
yeah.
Well, I think we have just enough time to answer the one reader mail we got this week. maybe we have 10 minutes. Hopefully we can get through this. So we got an email from Thomas, which is super cool. Super cool listener. Thank you, Thomas. They say, "Hey folks, as usual, I'm enjoying the cast. After the most recent episode, I found myself wondering how you approach criticizing the press. I share many of your misgivings, but I never know how to articulate them. I am white and I perceive male pretty much by default, so I have anxieties about drawing in horde little gamers when I make a point critical of game stress. How do you strike a balance? Also, to speak to your points about the press not holding individuals accountable, I agree. It seems clear that a lot of the issues with games journalism are those of access journalism, though there also seems to be an element of general enthusiasm for popular gaming figures. Recently, The Verge ran a piece about PewDiePie encouraging his fans to donate to charity, noted that one of those fans was Notch, but failed to note that both individuals are raging bigots. Similarly, Kotaku ran a piece after Ninja said the N-word on stream that oddly makes excuses for him. The specific one that comes to mind is an invocation of there is no ethical consumption under capitalism. This isn't a slight on either writer. Both individuals seem like perfectly nice people, but they're examples of journalists failing to hold gaming figures accountable, figures that repeatedly prove that they don't deserve the benefit of the doubt, no less, in cases where access really isn't an issue. I don't really know what to make of this, but it keeps happening. You all are much more in the know about this stuff than I am. Why do you think the games press botches things when access isn't a factor?" Whew. Okay.
Yeah. This is, it's bigger than gaming, too.
Yeah.
Honestly, the whole time you were reading that, I just immediately think of Total Biscuit.
Yeah,
because like there's a huge lack of criticism with him, and then obviously when he passed away that happened too, and for some reason I don't know, like we have the Game Awards where we reward people like this, and we reward them by watching their streams and promoting their streams and companies partnering with them to have exclusive early access to games, or you know what I mean, like we just give them so much stuff. And I think, I don't know why the press is uncritical, but generally gaming press is often uncritical, I guess. So maybe it's just sort of like there's no challenge there there's no motivation to be critical like that, I guess. Because you even have those things where it's like, I'm going to make a Kickstarter and I'm going to interview Total Biscuit and I'm going to ask him about the controversy stuff, like, but I'm not going to like take a side. So, because we were just talking about that last week, right?
Yeah.
About the, what story was, were we talking about?
We were talking about Eurogamer and CD Projekt Red.
So it's like,
GOG.
I don't know why. I guess I'm not sure what the, like you were saying last week is like, you're afraid, a lot of times journalists are afraid to be critical because it often means they can't like get a game for review, or I don't know, they won't be liked by, or maybe get like talked bad about from Total Biscuit, because Total Biscuit definitely did that on like his YouTube videos or streams
absolutely.
Or whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
like,
so I guess it's like sort of a just like a fear thing, like I don't know, like it's just,
it might be, I mean,
yeah,
it's courting controversy. I also think a little bit is editorial. Editors
too.
If editors are not catching this stuff, or editors aren't putting an emphasis on that, that can also kind of affect coverage.
Just letting things go. And editing generally in gaming, right? Games writing is kind of low in a lot of ways, too. Like, a lot of stuff kind of goes unedited.
That, too. But also, I think that there are editors who don't want to make something as political as it could be, or to strike as strong of a position as they could be, because either they think that the access is going to get revoked, or it's going to put spin on the outlet in a way that doesn't I think a lot of places don't want to brand themselves as being the like hard whatever on something, which is silly, because I think there's, you know, I mean, like, look at Waypoint is a good example of having a moral and ethical and sort of critical stance.
You are
on
cutting out
things.
A ton for me.
They're like, their
and
coverage
I,
is not afraid to just
Discord
presuppose
thing is like full bars.
That maybe Total Biscuit was an asshole, or maybe this person is a racist, or, you know, like things
like
that.
I mean, it
won't
affect the recording, but I can't
even
tell
you
what
you're
saying.
And I wish that more outlets did that. But also, like, you know, there's also kind of safety considerations, too.
And actually,
is like,
no, I don't even hear you at all.
Who are you having cover this story? Are you going to put them into jeopardy if you have them tweet, you know, Total Biscuit is a, you know, transphobic bigot or whatever?
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. I've definitely seen writer friends of mine go even the tiniest fraction out on a limb to say, to call someone a clown to their face.
Yeah, yeah.
And just get harassed.
And just get, yeah, because gamers, yeah.
But here's the thing. On the other hand, if you have a decent editorial staff, you should be protecting your writers so that they can say things like that. You know, don't make them moderate their own comments. Don't make them have to read social media. Don't make them have to catch the brunt of the abuse. But, you know, it's complicated.
It matters. It varies depending on each outlet too, and each writer in some ways too. So
as far as criticizing the games press, because I think that's something a little bit more what we have to deal with. I don't know, Tyler. How do we strike a balance on that one without inviting shitheads? You know, like how do you do that?
I don't know, like. I generally come from this perspective that games press is not critical enough. Like, that has always been my thing. I think I think there is too much positive. This sounds bad, but like, I think there's too much positivity in games. I think there's not enough. Like, and this is something that Nick Capozzoli, I think that's how you say his name. Mm-hmm. And I really agree with it, because he said something on Twitter. He's no longer on Twitter, but he said this on Twitter. He said, like, I want to see more. Like, honestly, negative reviews of games, or negative features about like kind of things that you would assume is negative, but like that are actually just more critical, because people just are so open to just being like, this thing's really amazing. I'm going to describe how it's amazing, and it like challenge yourself to be like, what is this something that's like just like sticking with me that I don't like? And I think that affects talking about people too. Like, people will just talk about how like that Ninja did a stream with Drake, but they won't talk about how he's like racist.
Yeah.
And I mean they will. I'm pretty sure Kotaku did write a story about that, right? But like we gotta remember that stuff, and we have to like, that has to be part of your take, I guess. your I don't know, assessment of these people that are really popular in people who will pay attention to, the people that will read, like the audience, like they have audiences that will read those stories, and we need to be, I don't know, good about that stuff.
I feel like we don't have a lot of people coming to like agree with us about criticizing Kotaku or whatever, because we're also still marginalized people and they don't want to agree with us. Like, I've had no people on this planet be like, from like Kotaku in Action or like 4chan or whatever, be like, oh yes, she has something to say, because guess what? They're often criticizing the games press for like saying shit's bigoted in video games, or saying shit's sexist. They're not criticizing, like, if they're criticizing for stuff like collusion, they're not doing what I'm doing, which is like saying that maybe this press outlet should call someone a racist. It's two very different perspectives that don't overlap. Like, there's not just some like broad like games press should be better that everybody agrees on, because those people have a very specific agenda, just like I have a very specific agenda.
Yeah.
And those two things don't overlap.
A lot of times those criticisms are also sort of uneducated in a way, because like we've both written
a lot, and we know people who write in at these outlets and stuff, and so we know like what it's actually like to just work every day at like Otaku or whatever, like Giant Bomb, stuff like that. So I mean, not that that's an excuse, but I'm saying like sometimes when you see people say like it's collusion, it's like it's not collusion. It's, you know, like it's more complicated.
Yeah,
like,
I'm not calling out these places for like collusion. Because
right. And I think that would be the difference between like us and a lot of like, I don't know, gamer people seem to do that. Not all of them, obviously.
They have not an informed or charitable opinion about journalism in general. So they're kind of coming from that position, whereas like, we know the things that games writers and press are doing is journalism, is essays critical, that sort of thing. That's already a foundational premise of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't think that this person not shouting out that person in an article for a cursory mention is somehow the great proof.
Yeah, see, I don't get over that. Yeah.
The get games journalism is, you know, super unethical and all this shit, and that was always a smokescreen for other nonsense, and that there's been actual ethical concerns that no one seems to be bothered about, and like so
that stuff doesn't bother me. It's just like, you know, like if we're going to do a giant article about Red Dead Redemption and we're not going to talk
about
the
labor
stuff,
practices
but like, also sort of talk about it but not be critical of it,
yeah,
that's where my issues are. Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. You can't, you gotta be, you, this is what I'm talking about, you gotta be more critical.
Yeah.
We can't let these games and, like, people who make them just go and say whatever they want, because that just, I don't know, it just really bugs me when people do that, and they do that all the time. And it always, and that's the thing is, like, we do that from the beginning of, because Games Press often is sort of a cycle of, like, you know, preview stuff, like, before the game's out, then it comes out, because it's, you know, they're consumer products. And that always ends up in like reviews, and so a lot of reviews just aren't very critical, because they always just seem like they're just like an extension of being excited about the game, and I am so tired of that. That is like something I absolutely hate, and I don't know, I just think we could do better. That's the kind of stuff that it like I have issues with, versus like offhand mentions or whatever. I mean, obviously it depends, I guess, on the people in the outlet and stuff like that. Like, the people, not the people, like, writing it, well, also the people writing it, but also the people they're talking about. Because, like, Total Biscuit, you know, he did a lot of horrible things versus, maybe if we're comparing to Ninja, it's maybe a little bit lesser, but I don't know. I just think, I don't know. It's interesting just because this seems to be coming up more. It seems like there is more complex issues in what is being reported, like the Red Dead thing, and like we talked about with Naughty Dog and stuff like that. Because that's another thing, that like Naughty Dog, I'm sure a lot of people will forget Naughty Dog stuff when Last of Us 2 comes out, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and it's like, so stuff like that, it's like, I don't expect everybody to like have a review that talks about it from that angle or whatever, you know what I mean? But it's just like, I expect people to just, I mean, that's your job, is
to remember
job. That stuff.
If you're doing reporting, that's your job.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, like, I think us as sort of independent, you know, podcasters, writers, essayists, freelancers have a little bit more freedom to talk about games press needing to do better. I mean, that's
I don't work for Kotaku or any of the sites, so I can say stuff.
I think
stuff,
we can
say
that sort of thing, and I don't. I've never felt like, oh, I can't say this stuff because some dude from 4chan's going to pick up on it. The dude from 4chan doesn't even know I exist, or if they do, they don't think I'm human, so it's not really that much of a factor. So
it's not worth my time to worry about 4chan Reddit, like, people, because I don't care.
Yeah, plus also shitheads tend to not read my Twitter or listen to this podcast or anything like that.
I used to care. Like, at some point I was just like, I don't have time. Like, I just do not care with trying to like convince people or listen to people all the time. I have to live my life too.
Yeah. Plus it's like, people who should listen to me already don't, so it's not really, I mean, like, to be completely cynical, other progressive leftist dudes in game spaces already don't listen to me because I'm a woman and they think I'm stupid. So it's like, I just sort of have carte blanche to say my thoughts about how how I feel Games Press should be handling their shit. So I don't know, whatever. Anyway, I think that's probably a good place to end the show for today before it gets too bleak. But thank you for your question, Thomas.
Yeah, thank you.
If you have any questions, you can send it to us on Twitter or our email, which is makeitsoundfiction, all one word, @gmail.com. Tyler, where can we find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at Tyler Culp, TylerColp. I'm also I stream for Blizzard Watch, twitch.tv/BlizzardWatch. I also write for Blizzard Watch. I have some articles on fanbyte.com, and I guess that's it. I always feel like, I have my YouTube, you know, honestly, yeah, I have my YouTube, youtube.com/Tyler_Culp, and I was just thinking about, because I was writing about like all the stuff I had done this year, and I still think that both our LA Noir playthrough on there is really good, and our Tacoma one was really good. Mostly, the Tacoma one's really good because it was like us being surprised by a game that we were into but didn't ever play.
Yeah.
And then we just like played it together and we're like, wow, okay, I really regret not buying this earlier.
Exactly. Apparently. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's just, I mean, it's a whole series, but it's still like, I was kind of proud of that at least, that, and it's on my YouTube. So
You can find me at Apple Cider Witch on Twitter and Apple Cider Witch on Twitch. I also stream for Blizzard Watch. As well, I also have written some stuff for Fanbyte, and I tweet a lot, so you know, if you just want to follow me there, you know,
don't, it's not really worth it.
Oh, shut up. Also, if you want to follow the show on Twitter, you can hit us up at MISFcast on Twitter. If you want to send us wonderful comments, praise, insults, whatever, or questions, you can send them there. Also, if you love the show, you can rate us and review us on iTunes. It means a great deal. We'll also read your review on the show. You can send all of your questions and comments to our email as well. Also, if you like the show, tell your friends, retweet us. Really helps us out. Word of mouth is how podcasts get around. And finally, our intro and outro music is done by Maddie Myers, and you can find everything that she does at Midi Myers, which is MIDIMYERS.net, or Mini Myers on Twitter. And we will see you next time.
Bye.